come in Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, with the greatest population concentration in Asia. I have a 165-year cycle, take that, Andy, that says the East will continue to dominate global growth into the next century. The rising Eastern Hemisphere trend started in the early 1980s and will continue until around 2065. Growing conflict, like emerging innovation and technological disruption, foreshadows higher growth and change in the future. After the 2016 peace accord was signed in Colombia, an international agency claimed that the entire Western Hemisphere was now free from major armed conflicts. Wow! Except, it's actually a bit of a contrary indicator, longer term. Greater peace is a sign of maturity and slower growth, which perfectly describes the Western Hemisphere. Older and aging countries will tend to be less violent and rebellious, but they'll also grow slower or decline. Bigger than Brexit or Trump? All of this is to say that Brexit and President Trump are just the beginning of this revolution. The effects of zero and negative interest rates are now finally showing signs of hurting more than helping. This is the peak of the massive demographic and technological trends that created the second phase of globalization on a large scale, starting after World War II. Globalization is peaking, with a sharp backlash toward greater sovereignty and protectionism, exactly like the 1930s. But every cycle has its expansionary phase, and then its consolidation and deleveraging phases. This is the peak of the dramatic growth of Western and developed countries and will lead to the continued rise of emerging and Asian countries. That's why we see more volatility and civil unrest in those areas. We need to buckle our seatbelts now to prepare for not only a great debt and financial bubble deleveraging and deflationary period in the next several years, but also a time of true revolution in everything. I'm talking everything from political and social structures to business organizations reshaping and reforming for many years and even decades to come, just like after the Civil War. I'm talking the bottom-up network revolution in everything. It's time to hunker down in your business and household finances. Cash out of the bubble in all risk assets for just a few years, even if you get out a bit too early. Crashes happen much faster than the bubbles build, so don't wait for the horse to bolt before closing the barn door. Consider where you should be living and target less bubbly areas that are safer and more aligned with your political and social values. And if you get ready now, you'll have plenty of opportunity to profit when the time comes. I'll give you the details in Part 3. Also, check in at DentResources.com regularly. Chapter 5. An Even Bigger Cycle. Inflation is a sign of progress in the longer term, not the monster that economists make it out to be. Harry Dent. As I explained in Chapter 1, we're seeing world-changing shifts in politics, economies, and societies, thanks to the 250-year revolution cycle rolling over us, on top of the 84-year populist movement cycle and the 28-year financial crisis cycle. Besides that, and I'll tell you more about this in later chapters, we have a continuing adverse 34-year geopolitical cycle that turned down in 2001, on the day of 9/11 to be precise, and will remain negative into early 2020, with terrorism, ethnic tensions, civil wars, and so on. We've been in a downward-trending boom-bust cycle, as we'll be describing in Chapter 6, since early 2014, and will continue on this path into late 2019 or early 2020. Governments can fight such a declining trend with free money for only so long. And aftershocks and demographic trends will be felt into late 2022. But there's also an even bigger cycle at play that I briefly referred to earlier, the 500-year mega-innovation and inflation cycle. Economists generally see inflation as a bad thing, whereas it may be the ultimate dark matter for the economy. What's wrong with these pinheaded pencil pushers? They know nothing about the most important principles of our economy and the naturally oscillating dynamics of innovation and change. They think that we can incrementally grow with few and only minor setbacks, and then settle into a nirvana-like state forever, with no more recessions and no more substantial inflation or deflation. Do they think they can design a greater system than God or the invisible hand? They think they can turn our dynamic economy into a machine. It's not a machine. It's biological, diverse, complex, and organic. What's wrong with them is that too many of them live in academic ivory towers and don't have to run real businesses or deal with real life in any significant way. Yes, short-term inflation can be a bad thing. Like the falling productivity and rising prices in the 1970s and the oil embargo that made it worse. Or when we have great wars at short-term costs and inflation that we can't pay for at first, but that can bring great innovation and changes in global markets and powers. Or when a short-term natural disaster makes certain things radically more scarce and expensive, like a bad freeze in Florida that raises orange juice prices. But even those short-term challenges bring innovations that offset the setback and allow for growth again. In the long term, inflation is clearly a sign of progress and of a rising standard of living. There is no question about that, historically speaking. When did we have the greatest decline in living standards in modern history? The Dark Ages, a 500-year bear market between 450 and 950. When was the last terrible downturn? The deflation of the 1930s. But both periods were followed by major growth accelerations. New technologies, which develop out of adverse periods of inflation or deflation, allow us to move to higher density urban areas and specialize in labor. We earn more and contribute more. But again, delegating to specialists and the costs of managing more complex urban areas combine to raise the costs of goods and of government. Investments in new technologies, infrastructures, and more integrative government services and regulatory agencies create greater growth and a higher standard of living, compared with what you'd find in more rural and lower-cost areas of living. This is the paradox. Who's richer, urban or rural households? And which countries are richer? Urban ones. In emerging countries, urban households tend to have 3 times the GDP per capita of rural ones. Developed countries with higher urbanization and technology tend to have 6 to 8 times as much income per capita as more rural emerging countries. Urbanization and new technologies allow better and more specialized work and trade, just as Adam Smith understood in the late 1700s. We have to pay specialized workers to do what they do best, so we can do what we do best. But that comes with a price. Specialization raises the cost of almost everything, except the emerging high-tech goods that become radically cheaper and drive change, from autos to computers. At the same time, we earn much more than the added costs of our specialization, and we see greater value and greater job prospects in more urban and high-trade areas. So, we get inflation and the need for more dollars and credit to facilitate such trade and specialization. And we get long-term inflation. Long-term inflation is actually a sign of progress in people's standard of living. It's largely a result of increasing innovation, urbanization, and expanding demographics. Goldbugs will argue that the value of a dollar has gone down 97% since 1900. Due to the fact that so many more dollars are in circulation through cash and credit. But that is such a wrong view. If the dollar was so devalued, how did our standard of living, adjusted for inflation, increase by more than 8 times since 1900? And how did our prosperity rise while government expenditures became a higher percentage of our economy instead of lower? If gold bugs want to go back to the times of Mayberry and the Andy Griffith Show, or Little House on the Prairie, they can be my guest. Break your back 100 hours a week to barely survive, and then be attacked regularly by bandits or hostile American Indians? No. I think I will take watching Homer Simpson on TV while someone else does everything for me and takes care of my kids as well. And I at least have some health care and retirement benefits. When inflation rises over the long term, it's a sign that this broader process of the specialization of labor is manifesting successfully. It also reminds me of my favorite classical economist today, Lacey Hunt. He explains the same phenomenon on shorter-term money velocity trends. He shows that when money velocity, or turnover of money, is growing, it's a sign that money is being productively invested. That means it can be reinvested and create even more growth in the future. More jobs, more income, and more wealth. When money velocity first starts to fall, even from higher rates, it means that money is being invested in more speculative pursuits that don't create real growth, just short-term gains and bubbles. Then it finally falls below average, and that means we're into the deleveraging of debt and financial asset bubbles, and a depression wherein the excesses get wrung out of our economy. What I'm talking about happens in longer and shorter term cycles. Longer-term rising inflation means rising investments and returns. Slowing inflation means less. This occurs in 500-year and in 60 to 80-year cycles as well. Urbanization is the greatest single driver of that, and that's propelled by innovation in new technologies when they finally move into the mainstream. Periods of falling inflation or deflation are signs that the process is deleveraging or resetting to foster renewed innovation again. And that seems to be unproductive in the near term, but is actually very stimulating to innovation and productivity over the longer term. The most powerful factor in human progress. The greatest period of deflation in modern history didn't come during the Great Depression, but during a period that occurred in the Dark Ages. This was after the breakdown of the Roman Empire and the great 1,000-year boom, sparked by Greek innovation starting around 500 BC and Roman expansion to follow that created a monumental bubble. Marcus Lemonis, on his hit TV show The Prophet, has three key principles for growing businesses: people, process, and product. For the long-term economy, technological innovations are the products, urbanization is the process, and demographics are the people. Globalization, with increasing urbanization and demographic growth since the latter 1800s, has been a major part of the rise in inflation and standard of living. And again, our income adjusted for inflation has expanded more than 8 times. Just since 1900, just after this 500-year cycle turned up in 1896, but only after a longer-term deflationary trend finally bottomed out in the wake of 5 depressions between 1820 and 1896. My view now is that the globalization trend accelerated on a larger scale around 1945, with the meteoric rise of Japan following post-World War II reconstruction. But that phase of globalization has peaked and is fading fast, as I've explained. Its very success has put radically different political, religious, ethnic, and income factions in each other's faces, increasing discontent and hate. Look at the increasing accelerating urbanization rate globally since 1920. It, urbanization, is the most powerful factor in human and economic progress. And what was the first major country to urbanize in response to industrialization? Great Britain. The power it gained from urbanizing allowed a small island nation to largely rule the seas and the world for more than a century. In China, the rate of urbanization will slow for a decade as the country works off its massive overinvestment in infrastructure and its rural migration continues to abate and even move backward. But the longer-term trend in urbanization, in emerging countries, will continue to the point of 90% full global urbanization near 2145, precisely when the 500-year mega innovation and inflation cycle is due to peak. Look at the growth in global trade as a percentage of GDP going all the way back to 1500. This is globalization, urbanization, technology, and the specialization of labor at work. Like any long-term trend, it's exponential and driven by new technologies that allow for it. Economies were isolated before tall ships sailed in the late 1400s. They were still insulated before faster and larger steamships barged through the waters in the mid-1800s. It wasn't until railroads that crossed national and regional borders, largely built in the latter 1800s, that we slowly moved toward becoming a global community. Jet travel began accelerating that trend in the 1950s, and then the internet became the largest global catalyst. As a percentage of global GDP, trade grew from 2% in 1500, after the advent of tall sailing ships in the late 1400s, to 5% by 1700. Then trade grew from 5% to 10% by the early 1800s, following the first stock-financed global trading companies. The East India Company in 1706 was the first. Then, there was the first rapid globalization surge on the centurial cycle, from around 1850 into 1912. The first large-scale steamships fueled that, with a 45-year innovation cycle rising from 1852 through 1875. Railroads came along with the next rising cycle from 1897 to 1920. This 45-year cycle is critical. I'll talk about it more in Chapter 6. But World War I, the Great Depression, and World War II interrupted Globalization Boom 1. An approximate 67-year trade boom started around the mid-1840s after a major depression and peaked in 1912. A 33-year bust followed, from 1913 to 1945. That was a Wave 1 uptrend in Elliott Wave terms, followed by a Wave 2 correction. It also demonstrated the 100-year centurial cycle I discussed in Chapter 3. Globalization Boom 2 started in 1946 and peaked somewhere between 2008, when the Great Recession hit, and 2012, when the euro hit its first major crisis, a 63 to 67-year expansion. That was Wave 3. That was approximately 100 years after Globalization Boom 1 peaked. And if this 100-year cycle holds, it will take until 2041 to 45 for this backlash against globalization to bottom out. Then we could start to see the beginnings of the next great surge, but likely not the strongest part until after the next global depression has run its course, by the mid to late 2070s. Here's why. When I adjust my generational spending wave in the United States for falling immigration and births in this economic winter season, our economy is projected to go sideways for decades. Then it'll hit its lows in the early to mid 2070s before potentially turning up longer term. This is based on rising births from 2024 onward, during the next global boom and positive geopolitical cycle. The combined demographic trends in the emerging world will also peak around 2065, and a marked economic slowdown will ensue. That's when I see the next Great Depression and economic winter season, between 2066 or so and 2074 to 77. This suggests weaker global growth as developed countries decline modestly, offsetting much of the stronger emerging world gains. But emerging countries are not, and will not, be nearly as high in income, GDP per capita, and typically only about 20 to 25% as affluent, even when they fully urbanize. Slowing developed country growth is the reason why investors and businesses have to get very serious about focusing on emerging countries, where the demographic growth and urbanization will take place. More on that ahead. Two sets of kids? By the top of the next 45-year innovation cycle, around 2055, when the peak of the second wave of the millennial generation's spending wave is due, we will almost certainly see breakthroughs in technologies that create much longer lifespans and higher fertility into later age ranges. That, coupled with suburban sprawl in emerging countries, could lead to a second global baby boom, with globalization returning stronger than ever. Then we could see a stronger and final phase of demographic growth and urbanization that doesn't peak until the mid-2140s on this 500-year cycle. Humans could start living to celebrate their 120th birthdays, and that would greatly expand and enhance our earning and spending cycle, and maybe make it possible for parents to have two rounds of kids. You could make all your mistakes on the first set, but then have perfect kids the second time around, and more finances to support them, and for psychological counseling for your first set. This would finally reverse slowing demographic trends, especially in developed countries, and create a whole new and more expansive dynamic. We won't be around to see any of that, of course, but the point is that we're only partway through the long-term 500-year cycle in progress and inflation. It started in the mid-1890s and runs through to the mid-2140s. The next global trade regression could last many decades before the 60-year-plus globalization boom 3, a fifth-wave advance that suggests globalization and inflation would peak for a long time ahead. But the most important insight here is that the next global economic boom will see slower growth and will be much more mixed and selective, favoring emerging countries that will continue to urbanize with still rising demographic trends and the commodities that they both export and consume. You, as an investor or business owner, need to focus in these areas after the crisis ahead. As I said in my last book, The Sale of a Lifetime, this will not be a time to invest in just anything, as was the case from the early 1930s onward. As a very long-term overview, I see a four-stage globalization cycle. The worst crisis would be over the next several years, and it would then take decades to really pay off in a rising economic productivity cycle again. Here's what that four-stage trend looks like. Stage 1. From the late 1800s to 1945, the innovation stage of globalization saw Globalization Boom 1 peak in 1912. Two world wars and the Great Depression sorted out political imbalances before globalization could fully blossom again. And blossom it did. Stage 2. From 1946 to 2012 or so, we got the growth phase, or Globalization Boom 2. Stage 3. From 2012 into as late as 2078, we'll get a shakeout period in globalization. Geopolitical imbalances must first be corrected before the next global boom can occur. And this will be a great challenge and take decades, not years. Stage 4. From around 2078 to around 2145, we'll get the maturity boom phase with Globalization Boom 3. So, by 2140 to 45, the world should be nearly 90% urban, with peaking long-term demographic trends and middle-class living standards higher almost everywhere. This is likely to be the best the world economy will look for a long time to follow. And the next dynamic longer-term global boom from around 2078 into 2145 will rival 1945 to 2007. But between now and the 2070s, the global boom will be a much more mixed picture than the blockbuster period of globalization that ran from World War II to 2016. Chapter 6. The four fundamentals that shape our world. When two of these cycles converge, it's distinctly noticeable. When three of them converge, it's exhilarating. When all four converge, it's a life-changing bubble. Harry Dent. As if the 500-year mega innovation and inflation cycle, the 250-year revolution cycle, the 100-year centurial cycle, the 84-year populist movement cycle, and the 28-year financial crisis cycle weren't enough for this revolution. We also have the downward convergence of the four fundamentals. Four cycles that are inseparable from our booms and busts and our successes and failures economically. Out of the infinite array of cycles that impact our economy and our lives, I have distilled it down to these four fundamental cycles that have really mattered over the last 30 years, starting with my first great discovery, the demographic-driven generational cycles. Let's look at each one in detail. Fundamental 1. The generational spending wave. The generational spending wave tracks the movement of a new generation as its spending predictably increases, peaks, and then decreases as it ages. This is totally predictable with modern demographic statistics. Because the baby boomers were, and remain, such a powerful force in the economy, to know in advance what their impact would be on stocks, markets, real estate, and anything else, I simply moved the birth index forward by 46 years, in the United States. And of course, I adjusted for immigration. At 46 years old, most baby boomers were peaking in their spending, having bought the largest house they'll own when they were about 41, and helping their kids through high school, maybe college, and then into the big wide world. For the Bob Hope generation, I moved that birth index forward just 44 years to match up with their peak in spending. They got married earlier, went to school for a shorter time, and had kids earlier on average. For the millennial generation, I moved the birth index forward by 48 for the first wave and 50 for the second wave. The peak spending age also differs slightly from country to country. For example, it's 47 in Japan and likely the same in Northern Europe. It was thanks to this cycle that I was able to forecast the unprecedented boom and bubble into late 2007 in the United States and the collapse of Japan in 1989. And when I back-tested it, it also called the 1950s and 60s boom and the 70s extended recession and inflation crisis. That's because demographics really drive the economy. They're that unseen dark matter again. New generations of consumers do predictable things at predictable times. The average person in the baby boom generation entered the workforce at age 20. They got married at age 26. Apartment rentals peak shortly after, and typically the first baby arrives when his or her parents are 28 or 29 years old. That stimulates the first home purchase at about age 31. As the kids become teenagers, parents buy their largest house. That's between the ages of 37 and 41. Boomers continued to furnish their homes into their 40s, and thus spending on furniture peaked around age 46. This is also the peak in spending overall for the average household. In the downward phase of spending, some sectors continue to grow. College tuition peaks at around age 51. And cars are the last major durable goods item to peak, at around the age of 54. That's when parents finally trade in the minivan for carting around kids and splurge on a luxury car. Savings start to rise from 46 forward, but surge the most from age 55 to 63, toward a net worth that peaks at age 64, a year after the average person retires at age 63. Spending on hospitals and doctors peaks between the ages of 58 and 60. When people are still paying more out of their pockets instead of using Medicare and Medicaid. Vacation and retirement home spending peaks around age 65. Cruise ship travel peaks at age 70. Then there are the peak years for prescription drugs, age 77, and nursing homes, age 84, mostly women. I've highlighted only the key areas here. The data can tell you much more, such as when consumers spend the most on camping equipment, babysitting, or life insurance. If you want to see more, get a copy of my in-depth research report, Spending Waves, The Scientific Key to Predicting Market Behavior for the Next 20 Years. It delves into hundreds of categories of consumer spending, with charts that show you the trend for each. This research could cost a large corporation $20,000, if not more. You can get it at less than $200. Find more information on that at dentresources.com. All of this is critical to understanding and forecasting the markets and economy, because as a generation moves through its predictable spending pattern, we see that there's an undeniable correlation between age and spending, with a peak at age 46 for the baby boomers and a few years older for the millennials. The only exception came from late 2008 onward, when central banks started printing money to mitigate the impact of the Great Recession and its brief deflationary trends. And I have been saying for years that it won't end well, as the massive divergence would clearly suggest. This unprecedented overvaluation represents the greatest divergence from my most fundamental trend, and strongly suggests that the greatest stock market crash in our lifetimes is just ahead. To summarize, the generational spending wave peaked in the United States in late 2007, as forecast 2 decades ago, and continues to point down into around late 2022. It peaked in Japan in late 1996, and the land of the rising sun's economy has suffered bubble crashes and been on massive QE, quantitative easing, life support, ever since. The baby boom in Europe peaked in 2011. This is the biggest reason that the Great Recession hit in 2008, and why economic growth has been so slow ever since, despite unprecedented monetary stimulus and the biggest something-for-nothing free lunch in history. Fundamental 2. The Geopolitical Cycle. The geopolitical cycle is roughly 34 years long, 32 to 36 years going back 200 years, and oscillates from favorable to unfavorable about every 17 years. The last positive arm of this cycle was between 1983 and 2000, during which time nothing significant went wrong in the world and the Cold War quickly faded. The first Iraq War lasted only 100 hours and didn't occupy and seek regime change. Since the cycle turned negative in 2001, however, we've seen an endless series of destructive geopolitical events. 9/11, two failed wars, endless civil wars including Syria, the Arab Spring, Russia's invasions of Crimea and Ukraine, the rise of ISIS, worse and more brutal than Al-Qaeda, the twin Paris attacks followed by incidents in Brussels, Nice, and England, extreme racial tensions in the United States over police brutality, you name it. This cycle has an impact not so much on GDP growth or corporate earnings, but on the risk perceptions of investors, because markets and economies are highly charged during the negative period of this cycle. Volatility is high. Fear simmers just under the surface. As a result, stock valuations during negative turns tend to be half of what they are during the positive swing. That's a big deal. It's the valuations of stocks, or the price-earnings ratios, P/E, that are most impacted. Robert Shiller has come up with the best measure of that by averaging earnings over 10 years to take out the distortions of shorter-term earnings swings. The geopolitical cycle nails these swings in higher or lower stock valuations, more so than any other cycle I have. I used to rely more on the generational spending wave for that, but the much lower stock valuations since 9/11 caused me to seek out and find this powerful cycle. The cycle continues to point down into around late 2019 or early 2020. And it's another reason why the huge divergence from quantitative easing and money printing shown in the spending wave chart is due to crash and burn. Valuations on stocks are likely to fall from as high as 32 in late 2017 to as low as 5 to 8 by early 2020. That's a big deal. In November 2015, I recorded a monthly Ahead of the Curve webinar for my Boom and Bust Elite members, in which I broke down the events that have taken place since this geopolitical cycle turned down in 2001. In The Sale of a Lifetime, I broke that chart into a series that highlighted events per year. It was shocking to see the timeline of events, but it reinforced the power this cycle has on every aspect of our lives. This compilation is available on the PDF. Fundamental 3, the 45-year innovation cycle. The peaking of major mainstream technology surges every 45 years. In 1875, steamships peaked and then dropped off rapidly. Up until 1920, railroads laced the dirt across continents before cascading downward. By 1965, cars had raced into the hearts and homes of middle-class citizens, and almost everyone finally owned one. By 2010, the internet and mobile computing were ubiquitous and had changed how we work and interact with one another. Right about every 45 years. And that's the key here. This cycle turns positive when clusters of technology go mainstream for about 22.5 years. This is what happened with portable computing and the internet from 1988 to 2010, with cars from 1942 to 1965, with railroads from 1897 to 1920, and with steamships from 1852 to 1875. And recall that the grand globalization cycle surged twice with these past four cycles. This creates high-growth, high-productivity periods due to the advance of such major driving industries. Higher productivity means better wages for workers and bigger profits for businesses. Although I'm highlighting the most dominant technology in each cycle, they always come in clusters. Steamships, canals, and the McCormick Reaper. Railroads, telegraphs, penicillin, and elevators. Autos, electricity, phones, radios, and TVs. Personal computers, wireless phones, the internet, and broadband. For example, a cluster of key technologies enabled mass production and the assembly line revolution, which was followed by the massive shift from city living to the suburbs from the 1940s into the 1960s. That was a big deal. Suburbs were cheaper and safer. It wouldn't have been possible without the convergence of autos, electricity, phones, radios, and TVs. Suddenly, everyday people could have more land and space, enjoy safer living conditions, and commute to and from work with ease. They didn't have to be within walking distance of their job or the nearest bus terminal or train station, and they were still connected to the growing and globalizing world. The other side of this cycle is more neutral. It's not as much like the other cycles that turn negative. After all, there is always innovation. Only, it's during those neutral periods that the next new technologies are emerging into niche markets, while the older wave is maturing and declining. A perfect example of this is biotechnology. Innovation continues exponentially in this arena, but many of the breakthroughs are not yet accessible to the masses. Watch out for this to burst into the mainstream when this technology cycle turns upward again, around 2032, along with nanotechnology, robotics, 3D printing, and alternative energy. And biotechnology is likely to break out earlier, as electricity did in the early 1900s. This cycle causes me to argue with some of the gee-whiz technologists. Yes, I agree that technological innovation is exponential, not linear. But it still comes in cycles. I don't expect to see as much progress in standard of living or longevity in the next decade, except in emerging countries that continue to urbanize and adopt the technologies that are already ubiquitous in developed countries. I know to look for the next mainstream technology revolution in developed countries between 2032 and 2055. That's when we're likely to see our real wages and lifespans expand more assertively, as occurred from the 1940s forward, two such cycles back. And such longer lifespans are the only way out of the demographic rut that aging developed countries are in, and emerging countries will ultimately find themselves in as well. And finally, Fundamental 4, the boom-bust cycle. The fourth fundamental cycle I watch closely is driven by sunspot cycles that vary between 8 and 13 years. Not as clockwork-like as many cycles I study, but the most invaluable in calling crashes and recessions. Have we not had significant recessions about every 10 years? Now, hear me out on this one. When I mentioned this cycle to my colleagues and loyal subscribers, they were skeptical at first. Then, some begged me not to talk about it in public or even to subscribers, because it could make me look like a crackpot. I didn't need to lend any more credence to the popular view that I'm just plain crazy. But my live-and-die-by-the-sword personality wouldn't let me follow their advice. In fact, their warnings just drove me deeper into the research to prove the value of this cycle. And the more I researched, the more evidence I found that this cycle is very real, very powerful, and has impacted markets and the economy for as long as we have economic data to review. Back to the mid-1800s, and we have sunspot cycle data back to the 1600s. And by the way, I'm not the only economist or financial researcher who believes in the power of this cycle. In fact, I first came across it when reading an article in Barron's. One of the largest fund managers, formerly at PIMCO, said it was the sunspot cycle that saved him from the 2000-02 tech wreck crash. As I've since discovered, sunspot activity affects many things, from satellites to electronic infrastructures to sunshine to rainfall to human psychology, all from higher solar energy at its peaks and lower solar energy at its bottoms. Do you know that both sunshine and rainfall are 20% higher at the peak of the sunspot cycle? In the recent cycle, the best scientists called for a peak in late 2013. They were early by a couple of months. It finally peaked in February 2014. But in the world of cycles, that's close enough to count as spot on. Now, the scientists are calling for the next bottom to occur around late 2019 or early 2020, which just happens to be when the geopolitical cycle is due to bottom and turn more favorable again, and when the worst of the United States' demographic downturn should be over. The good thing about this cycle is that it's more intermediate and better focuses on booms and busts within the larger cycles that the other three fundamentals are good at forecasting. It can tell you when there'll be recessions or stock crashes, even in longer-term boom periods. It also targets when the biggest crashes are likely to happen in longer-term down periods. This makes it the best cycle I have discovered since the generational spending wave. And if you don't see a rough 10-year cycle over your lifetime, you're blind. Early 1960s, early to mid-1970s, early 1980s, early 1990s, early 2000s, 2008 to 09, and now late 2017 into early 2020? All of our major recessions are close to 10 years apart. Again, it's not as clockwork-like as many other cycles Andy and I have, but scientists are good at predicting the up-and-down swings that we don't have the specific skills to calculate. The cycle is best at pinpointing when we'll see major crashes, financial crises, or recessions/depressions within the three larger fundamentals. Going back further to prove the value of this cycle without the shadow of a doubt, 88% of the recessions and stock crashes since the mid-1800s, where we have good economic data, have come in the downward phase of the boom-bust cycle. And the other 12% have come close to the down cycle and perhaps just got triggered by geopolitical events a bit early or late. There is no chance this is a coincidence. The last sunspot cycle peaked in March 2000, and the dot-com crash followed. It bottomed between 2008 and mid-2009, right when the Great Recession was at its worst. These last two cycles were the longest from top to top, at almost 14 years, from March 2000 to February 2014. That threw off Ned Davis's classic 10-year cycle, which predicts that the worst recessions and stock crashes come in the first 2 to 3 years of every decade, but not in 2010 to 2012, when I most expected it. Ned Davis's cycle is right, but it's not as clockwork-like. The boom-bust cycle is my new secret weapon, because scientists can predict the sunspot cycles that drive it pretty darn accurately. And very few people know about this cycle and what actually drives it. When I had to dig deeper to figure out why Ned's cycle didn't work as well as it should have, after my other cycles suggested a major crash between 2010 and 2012, I found the sunspot cycle. I knew this would be controversial for my listeners and subscribers, so I made sure that it worked in history. And I found that it did. In spades. When I revealed it to a broader audience at our annual Irrational Economics Summit, there was still skepticism, until a lady stood up and proclaimed, "I'm a nurse in an emergency room, and my husband is a police officer. We can testify that when there's a full moon, with slightly higher reflection of light and energy, there are more extreme events, more accidents, more murders." So how could 20% higher solar energy not make people feel more optimistic or act more extreme? Why would such higher solar energy not create greater bubbles? That was when my audience got this cycle beyond my long-term documentation. So be skeptical about this cycle at your expense. Like I said earlier, the current sunspot cycle peaked in February 2014 and points down until around late 2019 or early 2020, after being one of the most extreme in history. With this more precise cycle pointing down, along with my three other fundamental cycles, I say, if we don't see a major financial crisis hit by early 2020, I'll quit my profession and become a limo driver on the Gold Coast of Australia. And I'm not only betting on the boom-bust cycle. When these four fundamentals converge, as they have done only twice in the past century, in the early 1930s and the early to mid-1970s, a major financial crisis and deeper downturn are almost certain. When they converge with the three harbingers of revolution and the centurial cycle, that's world-changing. That's revolutionary. The only major cycle pointing up is the 500-year cycle. And that's why I don't see the deep economic and financial crisis ahead as the end of the world as we know it, as some of my bearish colleagues would have us believe. It's criminal that the president and his men and women, and in fact all world leaders and their support staff and their economists, can't see what's right in front of their faces. The worst years for these four fundamentals will be between late 2017 and early 2020, period. There will be aftershocks into at least late 2022 before three of my four cycles turn back up again together. The demographic cycle turns up around 2023. The geopolitical cycle and the boom-bust cycle turn up again after early 2020. Only the innovation cycle continues to move sideways until 2032 to 33. If we don't see that happen, it'll mean that central banks have conquered the business cycle. But I don't think that's even a remote possibility. I just don't see how it can happen, based on my three-decades-long study of history and cycles, especially the rare bubbles that come only once in a human lifetime. Central banks have only created a greater bubble since the real bubbles, based on strong and predictable fundamentals, peaked between early 2000 and late 2007, just as my longer-term indicators predicted. This last bubble is all about artificial stimulus and the higher energy from a rising sunspot cycle. The economic winter season started in 2008 is getting ready to come back with a vengeance. Chapter 7. Deep in the Heart of Winter. There's just no denying that major winter cycles come once in a lifetime. Harry Dent. I've talked about the pervasive impact of demographic and generational cycles on spending and our economy, especially since the first middle-class, broadly affluent generation emerged out of World War I, the Bob Hope generation. But many economists are surprised to learn that the greatest driver of inflation is workforce growth. It costs a lot to raise young people until they enter the workforce. In fact, they cost everything and produce nothing until then. The simple truth is that younger people are inflationary. people in their rising family cycle are disinflationary due to their rising productivity. Older people are deflationary as they downsize, retire, and then die. Shortly after I developed the generational spending wave in 1988, I found an incredibly close correlation with inflation and a 2.5-year lag on workforce growth. And that indicator told me that inflation would fall into the peak of the baby boom spending cycle in 2007, and then ultimately we'd get deflation. The combination of the generational boom-bust cycle and the inflation-deflation cycle led me to an 80-year four-season economic model. As I mentioned earlier, this 80-year cycle correlates closely with Andy's 84-year cycle, and I now believe they're one and the same, with 84 years being the more accurate duration. The great part is that I could forecast both of these dimensions with simple demographic indicators. The last full cycle materialized over two generational spending waves, the Bob Hope boom from 1942 to 1968, on a 44-year lag on births, and then the baby boom bull market from 1983 to 2007, on a 46-year lag. Strauss and Howe's work in generational cycles, which focused more on the political and social realm, also suggests that major cycles occur every 80-plus years, over two generational surges, and in four stages. In between, there were long recessions. But it's the inflation cycle that gives this model its seasonal flavors. Think of inflation like annual temperatures. The spring season comes out of the last winter or depression season. The last was the Great Depression. In the economic spring boom, inflation rises mildly, as it did from 1942 into 1968. In the economic summer season, when the larger generation is entering the workforce at peak costs and low productivity, you get the maximum inflation rates, as in 1969 to 1980. Then inflation fell with the baby boom expansion as members of the cohort became more productive after entering the workforce en masse. This is the economic fall season, with the highest growth, as well as falling inflation and declining interest rates to boot. This is the season when you always see debt and financial asset bubbles inflate due to high growth and ever-falling interest rates. That was the 1983 to 2007 period. Then we hit the inevitable and most challenging economic winter season, which sees deflation in prices and the painful deleveraging of the debt and asset bubbles, as was the case from 1930 to 1942, and as is the case right now, 2008 to 23. This is why central banks have feverishly created free money and stimulus, to stave off deflation and that painful deleveraging. No president or central banker wants to have the next Great Depression on their watch. But as Japan has proven, you don't get back to the spring boom if you don't go through the winter cleansing of debt and asset bubbles. That hasn't happened yet, but it must, and it will. This is where the rubber meets the road. Let's compare the Great Depression and the economic winter season of 1929 to 42 and the one we're living through now, so you can see the impact of all these cycles you've just heard about. The Great Depression of 1929 to 42. The 100-year centurial cycle of globalization peaked in 1912 and fell through 1945. There was a first great crash and mini-depression between 1920 and 1922. The 45-year innovation cycle peaked in 1920 and was down into 1942, another factor in the crash of 1920 to 22. The generational spending wave peaked in 1929 and pointed down into 1942. Then it turned into the Great Depression. The 34-year geopolitical cycle peaked in 1929 and pointed down through World War II into 1947, adding insult to injury. Hitler became Chancellor of Germany on that 84-year populist movement cycle in 1933. The worst of the stock market crash and economic decline came between mid-1932 and early 1933 on the 28-year financial crisis cycle, The sunspot cycle pointed down from December 1929 through August 1934, the worst of the Depression, then again from July 1938 to April 1944, during which time we saw the second, less extreme phase of the downturn, and the worst of World War II. Yet the 500-year mega-innovation and inflation cycle continued to point upward from a low in 1896, telling us that there was more expansion and boom to come. This was not the end of the world or of America. The greatest convergence of all of these down cycles came between late 1929 and 1941, especially late 1929 through 1933. That period saw the worst depression in U.S. and modern history, and the worst stock market in centuries. Again, we know people don't like to think in cycles. So, as they did in the Men in Black movie, we'll flash the light in front of your eyes so you can forget this, after we've convinced you to make some very profitable decisions. The economic winter season of 2008 to 23. Fast forward to our current financial crisis.